Just like with the water cycle that we spoke about in Wizards Part 7, only a tiny fraction of the carbon on Earth actually participates in the carbon cycle relevant to us terrestrial creatures. And just like the water cycle, any carbon we have in our bodies today has certainly done the rounds over thousands or millions of years through plants, soils, other animals, the ocean, and the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution got underway, global carbon flows ran as follows. Carbon in the air, stored as carbon dioxide, is used by plants in photosynthesis and becomes part of the plant. Some of these plants get eaten by animals and the carbon in them is used in various molecules to make body tissue and to burn up energy. Other plants, or parts of them like leaves, just get old and die. This decomposition releases some carbon back to the atmosphere, as does the process of respiration by animals. The other 99.9% of the world's carbon that didn't participate in this cycle just stayed underground, mostly buried in the ocean, in sedimentary rock, and in fossil fuels. Before fossil fuel use by humans entered the scene, losses of carbon from the earth and into the air from decaying vegetation and animal respiration in the form of gases such as carbon dioxide and methane were pretty much balanced by carbon storage or sequestration by plants during photosynthesis. The carbon cycle chugged along in this balance between about 1000 AD and the early 1800s, and so the amount of carbon in the air stayed pretty much constant over this time period since the Middle Ages. And to give you some idea of magnitude, this annual exchange was about 100 million gigatons of carbon, where a gigaton is a billion tons, from the Earth into the atmosphere, balanced by an equal exchange from the atmosphere back to the Earth. But then came the Industrial Revolution, powered by the burning of carbon-rich fossil fuels and accompanied by massive clearing of forest land for agriculture and other purposes. These two activities have extracted another 7 to 8 gigatons of carbon out of the Earth's sources per year, of which the oceans and the world's forests have decided to absorb just over half of this release. So the remaining 3 to 4 gigatons of carbon has nowhere to go but into the air. Over the past 200 years, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen by 30% and the amount of methane has more than doubled.
Well, what you've told me is a bundle of news, and no mistake. He and his foul folk are making havoc now. Down on the borders, they're felling trees. Good trees. Curse him, root and branch. Many of those trees were my friends. Creatures I'd known from nut and acorn. Many had voices of their own that are lost forever now. Yes. I will stop it. And you shall come with me. You may be able to help me.
An excess of carbon gases like carbon dioxide and methane are known to trap heat in the biosphere, making things toastier for all of us. This so-called global warming has many known and unknown impacts on climate. That humans have significantly increased the amount of carbon gases in the atmosphere, and that these gases do contribute to temperature increases, is generally not in dispute between the two main parties on either side of the Kyoto Protocol. What is under debate is the degree to which global warming is caused by natural versus man-made factors. The fairly recently discovered indications that the Middle Ages may have been warmer than current ages has the leadership in the US scrambling to promote studies to show that natural causes are a primary contributor to climate change. Satisfied that humans are contributing to climate change, the countries that have now ratified the 1997 Kyoto Protocol on global warming are trying to do what they can to get as much as possible of this excess carbon out of the atmosphere by implementing mechanisms designed to reduce overall carbon emissions. But the naysayers team, reluctant to give up their high carbon diets and led by United States and Australia, are diverting significant resources into figuring out how to stuff carbon waste underground or in the sea in a process known as artificial carbon sequestration. The US has also developed a sudden interest in the climate endured by King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, when temperatures were much warmer than they are today. If only they can understand why the mythical knights were so toasty, they can cast doubt on the idea that human-induced greenhouse gases are largely responsible for climate change.
We're Knights of the Round Table, we dance whenever we're able. We do routines and all the scenes of footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot, we eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Now, global climate change presents a different set of challenges and requires a different strategy. The science is more complex, the answers are less certain, and the technology is less developed. So we need a flexible approach that can adjust to new information and new technology. I reaffirm America's commitment to the United Nations Framework Convention and its central goal to stabilize atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations at a level that will prevent dangerous human interference with the climate. Our immediate goal is to reduce America's greenhouse gas emissions relative to the size of our economy. My administration is committed to cutting our nation's greenhouse gas intensity, how much we emit per unit of economic activity, by 18% over the next 10 years. This will set America on a path to slow the growth of our greenhouse gas emissions, and, as science justifies, to stop and then reverse the growth of emissions. This is the common sense way to measure progress. Our nation must have economic growth, growth to create opportunity, growth to create a higher quality of life for our citizens. Growth is also what pays for investments in clean technologies, increased conservation, and energy efficiencies. Our nation will continue to lead the world in basic climate science research to address gaps in our knowledge that are important to decision makers. When we make decisions, we want to make sure we do so on sound science. Not what sounds good, but what is real. And the United States leads the world in providing that kind of research. The approach taken under the Kyoto Protocol would have required the United States to make deep and immediate cuts in our economy to meet an arbitrary target. The United States will not interfere with the plans of any nation that chooses to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. But I will intend to work with nations, especially the poor and developing nations, to show the world that there is a better approach, that we can build our future prosperity along a cleaner and better path.
It's certainly true that international markets for various forms of carbon products already exist. Why, there are markets for diamonds, graphite, wood products, and, of course, fossil fuels themselves. But now there's a new carbon market. In this new carbon market, a monetary value is assigned to a carbon gas emission allowance. Such an allowance could only have a monetary value if there are a finite number of such emission allowances and the total amount allowed in the market is close to, or even below, the total amount that is currently being emitted. For this market to exist in the first place, there must be someone or some body, most likely a government body, that sets the total number of allowances for the market. This is exactly what the European Union has done. It has used the cap-and-trade approach to moving towards Kyoto targets, which for the EU requires greenhouse gas emissions to get to 92% of 1990 levels by the end of this decade. As announced on July 23, 2003, the European Commission has formally adopted a market structure for a cap-and-trade system for carbon dioxide emissions that will begin operations at the start of 2005. Under the EU Emissions Trading Scheme, the EU member states will set limits on carbon dioxide emissions from energy-intensive companies by issuing allowances for the amount of gas each is allowed to emit. The total number of allowances will reduce each year until the final target is reached. A company that is able to lower its emissions at relatively low cost may sell its excess allowances, and hence, the argument goes, the emissions market will act as a catalyst towards finding lowest cost emissions reduction solutions. Other companies that have difficulty meeting their targets inexpensively can buy these excess credits in the market at whatever the prevailing market price is. In effect, then, they are providing some of the financing to the seller of the credits for the seller's emissions reductions efforts, since this was cheaper than reducing emissions in their own operations. And, if companies decide to neither meet their targets nor buy credits in the market to offset their excess, they will have to pay large fines to the government, well in excess of the market price of credits. Steve Drummond, the Director of Global Operations for CO2E.com, the world's largest broker in this new market, explains the process.
Emissions trading is a concept which has been really developed and proven in the States. Cantor Fitzgerald, our parent company, has been trading emissions, helping its clients to trade emissions since the late 1970s. If you look at the US NOx and stocks markets, they've achieved reductions in emissions of over 85% at less than 10% of the actual cost that was forecast when they started. It's been a very, very successful program. And so emissions trading is really the cheapest known way to reduce emissions to a given target. And that's what emissions trading is about.
CO2E is a subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald. We are brokers, and we broker all of the global emissions markets together with our colleagues in the States. So outside of the USA, that means mostly greenhouse gases and renewable energy. We do that in Canada and in Europe and in Japan.
So I run the global business. Really, all of the global emissions markets for greenhouse gases are all inspired by or caused in one way or another by the Kyoto Protocol. The EU system is huge. It's 25 countries, at least, possibly with the addition of Switzerland and Norway, which takes it up to 27. And it's going to deal in allowances which have an issued face value of about 20 billion euros per annum.
What's the trading unit?
It's one allowance, which is one ton of carbon dioxide.
Well, how does the emissions get monitored? Are they independently monitored? It seems like it would be easy to lie about your emissions.
There's a whole system of verifiers who are accredited by the government, and they sign off. So it's regulated.
It does seem like some kind of miracle that a bunch of 25 countries as diverse as the European Union, and who were at war with each other not so long ago, could unite over a proposal that is bound to bring some shocks to their local economies. Even the European environmental community seems fairly pleased with the EU's approach to global warming. But, like all such complex agreements involving so many varied parties and lots of different political interests, this one is not without controversy or room for abuse. Rob Bradley at the Climate Action Network in Brussels describes some of the main concerns.
My name is Rob Bradley, and I'm an energy specialist with Climate Action Network Europe. The Climate Action Network is actually a global network of environmental NGOs, so our members are NGOs like Environmental Defence, WWF, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and so on, but also a lot of organisations in developing countries, We were set up initially to coordinate input from the environmental NGOs into the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process, including the Kyoto Protocol and the follow-up conferences. But it's organized on a regional basis, so we're the Western European sort of center for the network, and because we're based here in Brussels, we do a lot of EU policy work as well. Last month, there was finally an agreement between the Commission, the Parliament, and the European Council, which is the member states, on how to put together a European emission trading system. Essentially, that system covers large point sources of carbon dioxide emissions. So we're talking about power plants, iron and steel facilities, oil refineries, cement kilns, glass manufacturers, and a couple of others. It will then set an absolute cap over those sectors. The system is relatively sound in terms of the structure of it, the monitoring and verification, and missing a target entails a penalty of about 100 euros per ton of CO2, it's about $110 US, as an automatic penalty. So that ought to act as a fairly strong incentive to comply.
Looking at this from the US, but living in the US. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're much further behind than the European Union in doing anything about climate change. So this would seem to be quite an amazing development in the EU. However, you seem to have problems with the way that the markets are working. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because, as you say, if you're looking at it from a US perspective, I think that compared to anything that's really being proposed anywhere else in the world, this is actually a pretty good and pretty ambitious proposal. And certainly, you know, it's the kind of thing that that, you know, we would like to see treated as a leadership issue, and other countries start to follow. On the other hand, looking at this purely from a European perspective and from an environmental perspective, we do have concerns. Now, I think one of the bigger concerns we've got coming up is actually comes in the form of a second directive. No sooner had the ink dried on the first one than another one is being proposed to link that emissions trading system with the Clean Development Mechanism and the Joint Implementation Mechanism, which are project mechanisms set up under the Kyoto Protocol. Now, essentially, the countries who have commitments under the Kyoto Protocol, commitments to actually limit their emissions, are, very roughly speaking, the OECD countries and the former communist bloc. Now, in addition to them making their own domestic emission cuts, they are allowed to sort of substitute for those in one of three ways, and these three ways are known as the flexible mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol. The more immediate ones that are proposed to connect with the EU emission trading system are joint implementation and the Clean Development Mechanism. Now, those provide for countries to undertake projects or to buy credits from projects undertaken by others that produce additional emission reductions and to use the credits coming from those in meeting their own target. So, for instance, if the UK was to go over its target by 10 million tonnes of CO2, it would need to get hold of credits arising from projects which have produced emission cuts of 10 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent. It can be done with other greenhouse gases. Now, that sounds all very well and good in theory, but in fact, in individual projects, demonstrating that you really have created an additional emission reduction is extremely difficult to do. And if you haven't generated an additional emission reduction, then essentially you're letting yourself off the hook in terms of meeting your own target while not making real additional investments elsewhere.
Well, how happy are you with the... you say it's difficult to demonstrate that you've met your emissions reductions targets. Are you happy with the system that works domestically?
Yes. The thing is that it's not so much that it's difficult to demonstrate that you have an emission of this level or that level. The thing is that, for instance, if we look at some of the projects that are being put together under the Clean Development Mechanism, there's a lot of large hydro dams there. Essentially, when a project developer comes along and says, I'm building a large hydro dam instead of building a coal-fired power station. Look at all the emissions I've cut. It's not so much measuring the emissions that's the problem. Is that really what the alternative was? Are they really doing it instead of producing a coal-fired power station? Or is this a hydro dam that they were going to build anyway? If it's a hydro dam that they were going to build anyway, then it's not an excuse for them to shirk their own targets back home. If you're trying to measure the total emissions of a Western country, it's complex, but it's certainly not beyond the wit of man to be able to do that. Most emissions come from fossil fuels, and people know how much fossil fuels they burn. But these projects are much less certain. They also involve quite often serious impacts of other kinds in the developing countries. And hydro dams are a very good example of that. I mean, we've got projects that have been touted as potential CDM projects, which involve evicting thousands of people from their land so that it can be reforested, or tens of thousands of people from their land so that it can be flooded for a large hydro system. These things are projects which need to be very carefully considered on their own merits, not just used as an excuse to get us cheap carbon credits.
What's your opinion on carbon sequestration and how that seems to be emerging as a more important solution?
In geological formations?
Yes.
And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a more complex area than carbon sequestration in plants, because theoretically, at least, you can find formations in which you can trap gas long term. For us, all of this misses the point, which is that the long term way of dealing with climate change and a number of other issues, whether other kinds of pollution or whether security issues that we're facing and so on, is to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. And anything which diverts us away from that is essentially missing the point. Now, having said that, if the climate science over the next few years is telling us, you've got to reduce emissions massively and you've got to do it now, would we be prepared to consider it? I think yes, it's an option which would need some thinking about. But essentially, it's as I say, really missing the point.
Despite these concerns, these developments in Europe have really made the EU the world leader in trying to stem man-made contributions to climate change. And without these efforts, it's possible that the Kyoto process would have collapsed after the US took its sabbatical to study the Knights of the Round Table. It's also interesting to look at what some specific countries are doing in response to the Kyoto Protocol. In 2001, the British government went even further than the EU emissions market and imposed a climate change levy in the form of a tax on business use of fossil fuel-based energy sources. Relief on this tax can be gained by meeting certain targets in the UK emissions trading program. Other countries face very different challenges in meeting their Kyoto targets. For less populated and more agricultural dependent countries like New Zealand, carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel use are not the main problem areas. Though one doesn't like to talk about these things in polite company, believe it or not, cow and sheep burps and farts are a much bigger problem. Cattle and sheep grazing and their subsequent emissions of smelly gases as byproducts of the digestive process contribute an abundance of the most potent of the greenhouse gases, methane. In fact, farm animal farts and burps account for about one half of all greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand. Unlike its less cooperative neighbour Australia, the country of New Zealand has ratified the Kyoto Protocol and had to do something about these smelly air bubbles. In a move that was far less socially acceptable than either the pops themselves or Britain's climate change levy, the New Zealand government took the drastic step of taxing farmers for the natural bodily functions of their farm stock. They introduced the world's first tax on farting. A farmers' rebellion got underway immediately, and it is unclear what will happen next.
I fart in your general direction!
The Kyoto Protocol will become official international law when the emissions levels of countries that have ratified the protocol amount to at least 55% of total emissions from the developed world. To date, The countries that have ratified Kyoto, including all members of the EU, Canada and Japan, account for about 44% of these total emissions. The US would add another 36% and Russia alone would add 17%. Hence, while the US continues to avoid the protocol, only Russia's ratification can bring it into effect. Now, Kyoto targets are based on 1990 greenhouse gas emission levels, and this benchmark here is the year before the collapse of the Soviet Union. The subsequent economic collapse in this region has meant that today, Russia's emission levels are actually about 30% lower than its Kyoto targets. By ratifying Kyoto, the protocol would become international law, and Russia would then be able to start making money by trading its excess emission credits. Rob Bradley at Climate Action Network discusses the situation in Russia.
What do you think is the outlook for Russia now to ratify the protocol?
I think, back to the old good old Kremlinology days, you can always find somebody to tell you almost anything. But I think the signals that we're getting from our Russian members are broadly positive, that we're expecting Russian ratification. It's a question of when rather than if. But, of course, you know, there are plenty of competing interests in Russia, and they'll all make sort of Delphic comments at one time or another. But certainly President Putin's recent remarks have been steadily more positive about the Kyoto Protocol.
Do you think that the US is putting pressure on them not to ratify?
It's very hard to say. I mean, certainly a number of people have suggested that that they are, and some of the US climate team does seem to spend a disproportionate amount of time in Russia. So I think, on the whole, the US administration would prefer to see Russia not ratify, simply because the continuing existence of an international regime to deal with a problem that the Bush administration says doesn't exist is probably a bit of embarrassment.
Steve Drummond elaborates on the pivotal role of Russia.
What are your expectations about Russia ratifying the protocol?
Well, there are a lot of people hoping that they will, of course. It's a bit of a balancing act. A couple of years ago, the Russians were expecting that they would have thousands and thousands, or tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of companies wanted to buy credits from them, and that they would hold a very strong position in, be almost like the OPEC of the carbon market. But with the withdrawal of the United States and then the European Union's curtailing the ability of European companies to buy the sorts of credits that the Russians have for sale, what it means, in effect, is that the Russians, instead of having hundreds of thousands of customers now, have a few politicians to sell to on a government-to-government basis, which isn't quite the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on the one hand, yep, they have a position where they're a net seller, so they can create revenue by signing. On the other hand, it's all tied up in it's not really financial transactions anymore, it's political transactions.
Well, and on that topic, might they then use this whole issue as a bargaining chip to get something else they want, like entrance to the WTO or something else?
I don't know what bargaining chips they're using. That is naturally the case. The European Union, in particular, would not like to think that it had killed the Kyoto Protocol, and so they are negotiating hard. Quite what the detailed terms of those negotiations are, I don't know.
Do you know if the US is putting pressure on Russia not to
I don't
sign.
Know. But
okay.
There is a lot of speculation and comment that they are, but who knows.
And on that topic, whether or not Kyoto officially comes into effect, I'm assuming that the EU will continue on its current path, and so will Japan, Canada, and other countries.
That's not necessarily so.
Okay.
I think that it would be very hard for the Japanese government, given their long sort of deflationary position, to justify quickly what would essentially be a voluntary emissions trading scheme if Kyoto was to fail. At the moment, really, the reason they're pushing ahead is much more to do with the fact that they want to honour the commitments that they sign up to than they're in a hurry to reduce their emissions. You know, a lot of Japanese industry was heave a big sigh of relief if the Kyoto Protocol was not ratified. In Canada, you know, the real politic is that Canada's biggest trading partner is the United States, and there are big worries in Canada about balance of trade shifting because the cost of production in Canada going up as a result of limiting energy consumption, which is in effect, you know, one big part of limiting greenhouse gas emissions. And so there would be a lot of pressure in Canada as well if the Kyoto Protocol were not to move forward, to simply not go ahead and do anything while the US, who's made a trading partner, is not doing anything.
Well, isn't that the same situation for Europe as well? Aren't European companies very worried about similar types of issues?
I think European companies are worried, but also in Europe there's a much stronger tradition of strong Green Party and strong command and control compliance-based systems for environmental issues. Europe has a long history of very tight environmental controls in all sorts of different areas.
Okay, so it's a cultural difference.
Over the next few months, we can certainly expect to see some very interesting dynamics playing out between the EU, Russia, and the United States. In the final week of July 2003, while the EU was busy putting the final touches on its carbon emissions market, while New Zealand farmers were rebelling against their Kyoto fart tax, and while Russia was pondering ratification of the protocol, certain high-profile leaders in the United States were continuing to emphasize the importance of the climate of the Middle Ages and labeling the pro-Kyoto team as environmental extremists. Perhaps the man in the U.S. most enamored with the Dark Ages is one Senator James Inhofe, a Republican senator from Oklahoma. He chairs the Environmental and Public Works Committee, and he spoke on the Senate floor in July of 2003. Here's some of what he had to say.
Well, what we're going to do next is to take you to the Senate floor on Monday, where Senator Inhofe spoke. He was speaking about the issue of what he calls environmental extremists, and the whole issue of global warming.
I've offered compelling evidence that catastrophic global warming is a hoax. That conclusion is supported by painstaking work of the nation's top climate scientists. We have those scientists included. What have they concluded? They concluded the Kyoto Protocol has no environmental benefits. Natural variability, not fossil fuel emissions, is the overwhelming factor influencing climate change. Satellite data confirmed by NOAA, balloon measurements, confirms that no meaningful warming has occurred over the last century. And climate models predicting dramatic temperature increases over the next 100 years are flawed and highly imperfect. And so, if you look at what they say, study that, you'll come to some conclusions. These are objective scientists, not fundraisers for some far-left environmentalist extremist groups. Finally, I return to the words of Dr. Frederick Seitz, a past president of the National Academy of Sciences and a professor emeritus at Rockefeller University, who compiled the Oregon petition. He said, "There is no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will, in the foreseeable future, cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and the disruption of the Earth's climate. Moreover, there is substantial scientific evidence that increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide produce many beneficial effects upon the natural, plant, and animal environment." These are sobering words, which the extremists have chosen to ignore. So what could possibly be the motivation for global warming alarmism? Since I've become chairman of the Environment Public Works Committee, it's becoming pretty clear. It's fundraising. Environmental extremists rake in millions of dollars not to solve environmental problems, but to fuel their ever-growing fundraising machines, part of which are financed by the federal taxpayers.
Senator Inhofe, just before your speech on the Senate floor the other day, you said that this was probably going to be a politically stupid speech.
It's politically stupid, Connie, because no one takes on the environmentalist groups. They are huge. They have the millions of dollars that they put in there, and of course they're fundraising all the time, and that's what a lot of this stuff is all about. And since I chair the Committee on Environment and Public Works, I just feel an obligation to tell the truth to the American people about what's going on. And some of when I first became chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee, I made three totally outrageous commitments. One was we were going to be basing our decisions on sound science. Number two, we would look at cost and have a cost-benefit analysis. And, I mean, those are really outrageous. Many of these environmental organizations, when they say you're going to use sound science, they just go crazy.
Who are the environmentalists?
Well, there are just a lot of them. They range all the way from the Sierra Club to the Natural Resources Defense, the Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, Save the Forest, and as I say, most of them are out there, and I said this on the Senate floor, that are really out there raising money, and they're raising a lot of money.
Global warming is a hoax?
You know, I really think it is.
What do you do to stop these environmental extremists that you call them?
Well, you know, I'm trying to tell the truth, but I gave a detailed history of the science and the lack of science behind some of these things. And, of course, the immediate thing was CO2, carbon dioxide, global warming. Let's go back to the medieval warming period. The medieval warming period happened between about 1000 AD and 1350. And during that time, the Earth was actually warmer than it is today. Then we went into what they call the Little Ice Age. That started 1350 to about 1900. And during that period of time, it got colder. Then, now this is interesting. I think it's probably the most key part of this whole debate. They went from 1900 to 1940 into another warming period. Then all of a sudden, from 1940 up until about the middle 70s or the late 70s or 1980, we went into a cooling period. Now, what happened in the 40s? There was an 80% increase in CO2 in terms of emissions. And so if there is if that causes global warming, why did it go in precipitate a cooling period for 40 years? And that's exactly what happened. So I think we need to look at these things logically, look and read what the hysterical people were saying 25 years ago, that we're going into this ice age and all that, and just realize. And we have a chart that goes back about 400,000 years, and it graphs the temperatures over a period of time. And it shows that we're right on schedule in the same types of fluctuations, and there's no reason to get hysterical. Particularly when the cost, and sometime I hope that someone calls in and asks, you know, what is wrong with signing on to Kyoto? What's the downside? Because it'd be a very, very expensive thing.
Rob Bradley at Climate Action Network talks about the U.S. and carbon emissions.
I don't think anybody's now expecting the U.S. to join in this round. It's not just about rejecting Kyoto as such, but the U.S., and this really went under the Clinton administration as well as the Bush administration, has largely adopted not to do anything about climate change. That's not to say there aren't, you know, good activities going on at state level and so forth, but the federal response has really been absolutely minimal. And so that means that the U.S. has progressively sort of essentially backed itself into a corner over this. Its emissions are rising so fast that it's difficult to see under any administration now the political will to do an about turn on that. Now, could the situation evolve far enough that sort of come the second commitment period the U.S. could come back in? Well, we absolutely hope so. And I think that will depend on a few things. One is public opinion in the U.S., but it'll also depend, I think, on the success of implementing this protocol in the countries that are going to implement it. You know, certainly our message for the EU is that there's no stronger argument when going to talk to the U.S. than saying, you know, we actually managed to cut our emissions at home. We did it with real policies and measures that have actually not crippled our economy but have created new opportunities. And that's the kind of thing that's going to win over the Senate.
Steve Drummond at COE2.com discusses the US position as well.
And if Kyoto does go officially into effect, do you think that it would have to put pressure on the US to go in the same direction?
There is a general expectation that the US will be in the second Kyoto period, which starts in 2013. Perhaps more compellingly, a lot of the large heavy industry, which is affected by greenhouse gas emissions legislation, plans on a very long timetable. You know, if you're investing in a power plant or in an oil refinery or something like that, you invest on a 30-year time horizon. And many companies believe that if you're going to bet that there's going to be no limitation on the emission of greenhouse gases in the next 30 years, then that's a pretty brave bet. Now, if legislation is still open, you have an expectation that greenhouse gases, the emission of greenhouse gases will not be a free good forever. So therefore restrictions will come into place at some point, but you don't know when. That uncertainty is very difficult to plan for and has its own cost.
At what point would it be too late for the US to ratify for this round? Is it already too late?
When people talk about this topic in the international fora, they say, well, it's too late, really. It would all be too hard. I think that there's simply no appetite in the European... there's no appetite on behalf of the European negotiators to sit down and discuss how to adjust the legislation to accommodate US position and US requirements.
Well, perhaps the US may end up stuck in medieval times after all, if the rest of the world moves ahead quickly without it. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 21. Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can get the text and references of all episodes.
Bearing in mind Frank Luntz's words that hope is what people desire most and what is in shortest supply, I want to close the program with an excerpt of a speech by Julia Butterfly that was also given at Soulfest and recorded by Scott Fratcher of Radio for Peace International. Julia Butterfly gained an international reputation after spending more than 2 years sitting in an ancient redwood tree, which she named Luna, in order to prevent its destruction as part of a plan by Maxam Corporation to log the ancient Headwaters Forest in California. Since coming down from the tree which still stands, she has traveled the world lending her support to others, fighting the destruction of our natural world. Julia had never engaged in any sort of political action before her tree sit, and she has said she grew up in a religious fundamentalist family. At age 26, seeking something different, she traveled west and saw the ancient redwoods, and under the canopy of the trees, found her purpose. As I want her words to finish the program, let me now thank Scott Fratcher of Radio for Peace International and Smithy for their contributions to this week's program, and Billy Bragg and Wilco for their recording of Woody Guthrie's song Unwelcome Guest that we use as our theme music each week, and you for listening. You can reach us via our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Now, Julia Butterfly.
One of the things that's really important to me that I always talk about, and those of you who've heard me before have heard one or more of all this before, because I know that it's kind of the water wearing away at the stone that makes it. And so for me, the water wearing away at the stone is about getting us to really, really, really reconnect. Not just understand it up here, and not to just talk about it, but to really get it. And so I've been thinking about when we're born, right? When we're born, we're so connected to the earth that we're like, right? And then you start to grow, and then you're like wobbling. And then you stand up, and then you're walking. And as that process is happening, you're being shaped by everything that's being imaged to you, whatever your environment is, and it's different for each person. But the more we're shaped by that, the further we get disconnected from life, from that interwoven thread. And so we begin to look at things and actually call them trash and waste and disposable. And I talk about this a lot because to me the disposability consciousness of our world is the mirror, it's the magnifying glass, it's the window into how not only have toxins been placed into our outward environment, it's been slowly dripped into the environment of our consciousness. And so where we've all become, we've all assimilated some of those toxins without even realizing it. And so I'm all about bringing out the inner child, in case you haven't told by now. I'm about reconnecting. I'm about getting back down in it and going, we have to move the toxins out. We have to recognize them for what they are without judgment. Because judgment in healing the toxins of our consciousness is kind of like chemotherapy to cancer. You know, it's like, why aren't we working on what's in the environment that's causing the cancer in the first place instead of the other option? And so we don't want to use judgment. We don't want to cut off the arm just because it's hurt. We want to work on holistic healing, and holistic healing can only come without a space of judgment. So it's really good to bring out the inner child for that, right? To be silly, to be creative, to be loving, to be nurturing. That's got to be a part of our healing. And for me, it's been kind of my mission ever since I came down from Luna, because when I came down from that tree, I felt in many ways as if I'd been living in a third world country for 2 years. And I came back into this very privileged industrialized nation and saw all the ways in which we are a part of disposability consciousness. When I'm at festivals, I walk around picking up other people's unconsciousness. That's what I call it. People are like, somebody was with me the other day. I said, oh, here's somebody's unconsciousness. And I picked it up. And they were like, what did you just call that? I said, that's somebody's unconsciousness. And they're like, oh, I get it. And it's like, because that's what it is, because there really is no such thing as waste, disposable, or trash. I've actually talked to people from traditional cultures all over the world and asked them if they're in their original language, in their traditional language, if they have words for waste, disposable, or trash. And as of yet, I still have not found a word in any traditional cultural language for waste, disposable, or trash. And the reason I haven't is because there's no such thing. Right? We're here looking at the solutions that are modeled from the earth, our home. And if you look at the earth, does it create waste and trash? No. A tree in the city on concrete, the leaves are waste and trash that we must use an electric blower to blow it out in the street so that someone else will come along with another electric thing and suck it up because it's trash and it's waste. It's bad. It's messing up our pretty little view. Our nice clean sidewalks. Get those leaves off right now. But in the natural world, a leaf is something that falls to the ground, begins to decay, becomes a natural fertilizer, helps hold in moisture, right? It's got all of these profoundly phenomenal, interesting systems that are because it's not trash. It's not waste. It's a part of a system. It's a part of a holistic system. So at Whole Earth Festival, I saw this sign that says, it's only called trash if you're not using it properly. Oh, yeah! That's one reason why I like you too. The younger we get, the more simple we break it down. So it's really, like, to me, it's kind of my evangelism, so to speak, because to me, the disposability consciousness is what leads to everything else. And so we have to start, to me, I want to talk about getting at the disease, because all of the issues are symptoms: deforestation, devastation of old growth, the prison industrial complex, nuclear proliferation, war, all the issues, lack of access to clean food and clean water. Every one of those issues are a symptom of a disease. And so we need to be working on the symptoms, but we also have to be working at the disease. And that's where I get riled up, because I want to create a community of people who are committed to get ourselves working at getting to the disease, and in the process helping change the system. And that doesn't mean we don't hold really bad corporations accountable. You know, and this is where I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I have to do it anyway. Because BP Solar is here, right? And I'm really glad that there's solar, but there's still petroleum in BP. And until there's no more petroleum in BP, I feel a little bit like the solar might be a little bit of a greenwashing. So, I want to invite them to go all solar, and then I'll be their biggest cheerleader out there. Or biodiesel. B can stand for biodiesel, you know? So, I mention that only because I'm about holding corporations and corrupt government officials accountable, and at the same time also encouraging them to do it right. So my thing is absolutely get rid of the petroleum, and I'm right there, you know? It's like, it's not the wave of the future, it's the heat wave that's oppressing us right now. That petroleum heat wave, global warming, I don't know, anyone else feel it? So, it's like, this is why I'm like, we do need to hold those systems accountable, but at the same time, I'm all about holding ourselves accountable first. And I love telling the story about Gandhi, because Gandhi was such a cool guy on so many levels. And one of my favorite stories, and I'm kind of paraphrasing it here, is there's a whole stream of people coming to see Gandhi, and a mother comes up and says, I want you to tell my son to stop eating so much sugar. And she's like, you know, he's eating so much, it's going to make him sick. And he won't listen to me because I'm his mom, but you're Gandhi. Right? Mom, Gandhi. And so Gandhi says, yes, I understand. Come back in a week. And if Gandhi tells you to come back in a week, well, then you just come back in a week. So they come back in a week, and the mother says, will you please, please tell my son now. He is like consumed. That's all he wants to eat is sugar. He's addicted to it. And he says, bring me your son. So she brings her son, and Gandhi says, you know, your body is a vessel. It's a gift. And you're hurting that gift right now. And when you eat that much sugar, you're hurting your ability to make your world a better place. You should really stop eating so much sugar. And the kid goes running up to his mom. I'm going to stop eating so much sugar. Mom, Gandhi told me to stop eating so much sugar. I'm going to stop eating so much sugar. And, you know, he's still hyper from the sugar. You have to give him a little while to calm down. And the mother comes up to Gandhi and goes, why didn't you tell him that last week? Gandhi said, because last week I was eating too much sugar. If we all lived with that kind of integrity, what would our world be like, right? Nobody knew Gandhi was sneaking snacks on the side. He didn't have to tell anybody. But he knew that holistic health meant from the inside out, not from the outside in, from the ground up. And so he was so committed to it that he knew that whether anyone knew it or not, it was not going to be holistic, lasting change if he wasn't living it himself. And so that's what our world is asking us all to do. Like, I've witnessed is festivals like this have gotten even more conscious on the level of production each year, and I'm really excited about that. And all the vendors who are serving food on non-chlorine bleach, non-petroleum coated, all compostable materials, I'm really, really, really excited. Yeah. But I'm even more excited about us not waiting on them to take the responsibility. I'm even more excited about us taking the responsibility ourselves. And any of you who've seen me before know I talk about this a lot. See, here's my sustainability kit, right? You go somewhere, you don't use paper, you don't use plastic. Lid acts like a plate. It's a sealable container. You go out to eat. You don't take your food home in petroleum. Like, you know, I get blown away at how many people I see standing in the health food line at the Whole Paycheck stores. And, that was also in the catalog, wasn't it? And they're standing in line to get the organic food, and they get it in petroleum. What's healthy and organic about that? I don't get the connection. Right, the bottled water, that's another big one of mine. Because this bottled water is a perfect example about how what hurts the earth hurts the people. Because so often we have this dichotomy that says if you're involved in social justice issues, then you don't care about the planet. And if you care about the planet and are involved in environmental issues, then you don't care about people. And plastic bottles are such a powerful example because where those plastic bottles are made, most of them are made outside of the U.S. where there is low regulation on the toxic effluents that are released from the making of those bottles. If they're made in the U.S., there's only slight restriction. And I always ask people, have you ever stopped to wonder why is there any legal amount of toxins? How do we get to a point where we accept the fact that there's a legal amount of toxins being put into our environment? If someone came up to you with both hands held out with a little bit of toxic yuck in one hand and a big pile of toxic yuck in the other hand, and here, pick one. You'd be like, no, I think I'll skip today. Thank you very much. But we've kind of been numbed into this acceptance that a little bit of it is okay. But either way, there's toxins going into the environment. But the people who work in these factories don't even make enough to afford the water that's been cleaned up to be put in that plastic bottle, that the making of that plastic bottle polluted the water where they live. You see the connection? So we have to realize that. We have to be willing to challenge our boundaries of comfortability, you know? We have to be willing to be made fun of. We have to challenge our own. Where are we afraid to toe the line and put our foot over because it gets a little scary out there, because it might get a little difficult out there? And I'm like on this mission to see that every festival like this that I go to, that vendors don't have anything, because we're all bringing our own, because we just have this little kit that goes with us everywhere we go. And it's like our new latest fashion. You know, like instead of a purse, it's like, can you see it on the runways? Fashion for the new era. Right? So it's got to be about us, because the beauty of it is, you see how much fun it is? Like, I'm touching on some stuff that's not quite so fun. But if we're really willing to live it, it's fun. It's amazing to me that every time I face a new challenge, if I do my best, and I'm a human being, so I do make a lot of mistakes. But in the process of striving to be a person who lives in consciousness from the ground up, from the inside out, I get an energy and a joy and a vitality that I never had before in my life. And so I live off of that. I feed off of that. Just like our friend in the front said, coming here for that inspiration and taking it out in the world. Our world is asking us to step it up, right? That's all there is to it. We can sit back and wait for the superhero to come in and save the day, and the day's not going to be saved, right? That we have to realize that we're all the heroes and the sheroes. When people come up to me and say, I could never have lived in a tree for 2 years, I'm like, neither could have I. Like, do you ever see that on your resume? Or like when you're a little kid, I hope to grow up someday and live for 2 years and 8 days in a tree. Like, it might be on little kids' wish list now, but, like, I don't know. But at least for me, it wasn't on my list of things to accomplish in my life. And if you had told me what was coming, I would have went running screaming in the opposite direction, because it was intense. But people know me as this 2-year, 8-day event, and they forget that it was moment by moment. There were times when it was breath by breath, and every breath became a prayer. If I can just make it through this one, I might make it through another one. And so it's like we all have our tree to sit in. And what I tell people is, if you wake up every day and ask yourself the question, what am I going to do today to make the world a better place, then you have found your tree to sit in. It's that simple.